Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast. Three women went home after a night of graduation parties in Springfield, Missouri. By morning, they were gone. Not missing in that vague, maybe they'll turn up kind of way. I'm talking about gone. Their cars were still outside. Their purses were still in the house. The house was still there too, just sitting there like it had nothing to say. And that's the part people can't quite spit out with this case. Not just that three women disappeared, it's that they seem to have made it home first. Now, hold on to that, because that's where this thing gets mean. This was June 7th, 1992 in Springfield, Missouri. A normal neighborhood, normal house, summer night. The kind that should have ended with people asleep inside and somebody making coffee the next morning. But instead, by daylight, Cheryl Levitt, Susie Streeter, and Stacy McCall were gone. And more than 30 years later, nobody has ever found them. No bodies, no proven exit, no version of events you can lay out on a table and say, there, that's what happened. Just a house, a few things left behind, and a case people think they know because they remember the headlines, the rumors, and all the creepy little details that got stuck to it over years. But that's a trap with this one, because the Springfield 3 is one of those cases where the story people remember and the record underneath it are not always the same thing. And before we get into the rumors, the suspects, the parking garage, the van, the psychic nonsense, all the junk this case has dragged behind it for three decades, we need to start where the case actually starts. Not with a legend, but with the night itself. Before this became one of those cases people argue about online like they're on the task force, it was just three women at the end of a very ordinary night. Cheryl Levitt was 47. She was Susie's mother and she was home. That matters more than people think. There's an adult in the house. Her mother is there, and whatever else people want to do with this case later, let's start there. Susie Streeter was 19. She'd just graduated. Out that night doing what just graduated 19-year-olds do, bouncing between parties, losing track of time, acting like the night's never gonna run out. Stacy McCall was 18, a friend, classmate, same orbit, same kind of night, graduation, parties, loose plans, people changing where they're sleeping because that's what young people do when the night gets messy and nobody's really thinking that hard about where they end up. This was not some big dramatic setup. It wasn't the kind of situation where, even in hindsight, everybody immediately goes, yeah, something was off there. Because it wasn't. It was a summer night in Springfield. A mom at home, two girls out celebrating graduation. The kind of night that's supposed to end with somebody asleep on a couch and everybody waking up annoyed and dehydrated. But instead, by morning, all three are gone. And that matters, because this case doesn't start with some giant warning sign. It starts with a night that looked normal while it was happening. That's what makes this one so ugly. So the next morning, that house on East Delmar should have had three women in it, but it didn't. June 6, 1992 was graduation night. That matters because graduation nights are messy by design. People are driving all over town, stopping at one party, then another, then some other one somebody swears is still going on. Plans change, sleepover plans change. Everybody's staying at Jessica's until they're not. It's loose, it's normal. Nobody's filing an itinerary. That's the kind of night Susie Streeter and Stacy McCall were having. They were out celebrating, moving between parties, doing exactly what you'd expect two girls their age to be doing after graduation in the summer of 1992, which is basically wandering through the night on vibes and bad planning. At some point, the plan shifts, and they end up going back to Cheryl Levitt's house to spend the night. And that matters, because now the whole thing starts tightening up. By the time the night winds down, Susie and Stacy are headed to that house on East Delmar. And from that point on, that house is the last solid thing in the story. Now, here's where I'm not going to do that thing a lot of people do with this case, where suddenly everybody talks like they've got the exact minute these girls walk through the front door, because we don't. I'm not going to fake certainty just because it sounds good in a voiceover. What we do have is the FBI's own window. By the FBI's account, the disappearance happened sometime between roughly 2:15 a.m. and 7:30 a.m. on the morning of June 7th. Now, that's a big window, bigger than people want. But it matters because it tells you what the record actually gives you, not what later retellings wish it gave you. So somewhere between the end of those graduation parties and daylight, this thing happens. That's the last part of this case that still behaves like a timeline. After that, you're not really dealing with a timeline anymore. You're dealing with a house. And by morning, that house has three cars outside it, but not three women. Now we get to the part of this case everybody thinks they know. The house. East Delmar, Springfield, Missouri. The place this whole thing keeps circling back to. Because once you get there, the story stops behaving like a normal missing persons case and starts feeling like a chunk of it is just missing. And the first thing that makes this house feel wrong is how much regular life is still sitting there. The cars are still there. And that matters for a really simple reason. Because if three women leave a house together in the middle of the night, your brain wants to build a normal explanation first. They went somewhere. They drove somewhere. Somebody got a call. Somebody changed plans. Fine. That's how normal stories work. Except the cars are still outside. So right away, the easy explanation starts falling apart. Inside the house, you get the detail that has stuck to this case for decades and probably isn't going anywhere. Their purses were still there. And let me slow that down for a second, because this is where people start dressing the scene up. You'll hear versions where the purses were lined up neatly, or placed just so, or sitting there like some kind of staged message. Maybe some of that came from early reporting. Maybe some of it got polished over the years by repetition. But I'm not going to oversell it just because it sounds creepy. What matters is simpler than that. Their purses were reportedly still inside the house. That's enough. You don't need to dress it up. It's already bad. Because if you've got three women gone and their cars are still outside and their purses are still inside, then whatever happened here, it does not read like a normal departure. It reads like something got interrupted and nobody ever got the rest of the story. And then there's the dog. Cheryl and Susie's little dog, Cinnamon, was reportedly still in the house too. That detail gets people every time, and I get why. It makes the house feel lived in. It makes the absence feel immediate. But again, I'm not going to stand here and pretend the dog solves anything, because it doesn't. It just makes the silence feel louder. That's really what this house does to people. It doesn't feel empty, it feels wrong. That's what makes the Springfield 3 so hard to shake. The house seems to tell you they made it home. It just never tells you how they left. And if that sounds like the key to the whole case, well, it should. But the problem is, by the time people understood how bad this was, that house may not have been sitting there untouched anymore. Now, here's where this case starts splitting into two different stories. There's the house people remember, and then there's the house investigators actually had to work with. Because by the morning of June 7th, people are starting to realize something's off. Friends show up. They're trying to find Susie and Stacy. Nobody's thinking. Preserve the scene, of course. Nobody's standing there in latex gloves like they're on CSI, which, by the way, did not exist yet. So they go inside. And that matters, not because they did something wrong, but because they did something normal. If you think your friend just didn't answer the phone or overslept or changed plans, you go knock on the door. If nobody answers, well, maybe you go in, depending on how close you are to them. If the dog's in there, if the cars are there, if the house feels off, well, people start moving. And in those first hours, the scene may already be changing. One of the details people always bring up is the broken porch light globe. You'll hear it repeated like it's the big clue that cracks the whole thing. There was broken glass outside. Somebody reportedly swept it up. That detail has been hanging off this case for years. Could it matter? Sure. Does it prove anything by itself? No, not even close. Same with the answering machine. There are long-running reports that there was a message on the machine, possibly strange, possibly important, and that it was accidentally erased before police could really work with it. That is one of those details that makes people want to throw a chair, because if it's true, it feels like the case losing a piece of itself in real time. But again, this is not some sinister movie moment. It's ordinary people in a confusing situation, touching things, checking things, doing exactly what people do when they still think there is a simple explanation. And that's the part people tend to miss. The house is the most famous part of this case. But the house the public remembers may not be the same house investigators got. From there, nothing in this case stays clean. Because once that house gets touched, moved through, partly remembered, partly messed with, now you're not just dealing with evidence anymore. You're dealing with memory. And in a case like this, well, memory can do a lot of damage. So at some point that morning, this stops being a weird, worrying situation and turns into a real missing persons case. The police get involved. The searches start. Family, friends, investigators, everybody's now trying to answer the same question from different directions. Where did these three women go? And how in the hell do three people disappear out of a house without leaving behind the kind of story that people are used to seeing? And the case moves real fast. Fast enough that it doesn't stay local for long. Interviews start. Search efforts ramp up. News coverage grows. Pretty quick, this thing goes from a deeply personal nightmare in Springfield to one of those cases the public latches onto because the whole thing sounds wrong the second you hear it. Three women, one house, cars still there, belongings still there, and no bodies. And that matters, because in cases like this, attention keeps expanding even when the hard facts don't. Police can search, reporters can call, cameras can show up. People can repeat the same handful of details so many times, they start sounding more solid than they really are. None of that magically creates a clean forensic trail if one isn't there. And in this case, there never really was one. No body, no confirmed abduction scene, no clean physical story you can lay out on a table and walk through piece by piece. And the next thing this case starts producing isn't answers, it's theories. Once this case goes public, it starts doing what big unsolved cases always do. It starts collecting things. Some of them matter, some of them maybe do, and some of them just never leave. One of the earliest details people latched onto was a series of disturbing phone calls reportedly received after people were already inside the house. Calls described as obscene, strange, unsettling, the kind of thing that instantly makes it feel like it's being watched. And maybe that matters. Maybe. Problem is, unsettling doesn't automatically mean connected. Creepy is not evidence. So yes, the calls entered the case conversation early, and they've stayed there. Fair enough. But as far as proving they came from whoever made these women disappear, well, that's a much taller order. And then you get the vehicle stuff. And man, every case like this gets vehicle stuff. A van. Some suspicious vehicle. Somebody saw something parked somewhere, near something, at some point. Maybe. You hear enough of these, and eventually, every white van in America starts feeling guilty. That doesn't mean ignore it. Vehicle sightings matter. Witness leads matter. But this is exactly the kind of material that can enter a case fast and harden way faster than it gets verified. The van stuff matters because it got into the story early. That's not the same thing as solving anything. And underneath all of that, the case starts splitting along the same line a lot of disappearances do. Was this somebody forcing their way in? Or was it somebody who got close enough to be let in? That's the real divide here. Because it doesn't give you a suspect, but it changes the shape of the night. If it's forced entry, you're looking at one kind of event. If somebody knew them or knew one of them or could get the door open without much trouble, now you're in a very different kind of story. And that's when people close to the women start getting looked at. Naturally, of course. Friends, acquaintances, people in the orbit. That happens in every case. It happened here too. Does scrutiny mean guilty? No. It just means proximity. And in a case this thin, proximity gets a lot louder than it should. By that point, the Springfield 3 already had everything a permanent mystery needs: a strange house, missing people, no bodies, and weird details people can keep passing around until nobody remembers where they came from, just that everybody knows them. And that's where this thing really starts to split. Because once a case starts filling up with details people remember instead of details people can actually prove, now you're not chasing one story anymore. You're chasing the case and the version of the case people built around it. By this point, the Springfield 3 has already become the kind of case people can't leave alone, and I get it. So let's do this the right way. Let's walk through the stuff people always bring up, what they're actually talking about, and how much weight any of it really carries. First, the hospital parking garage theory. If you've been around this case for more than 5 minutes, you've heard some version of it. The rumor is that the women were buried under a hospital parking garage during construction. Depending on who's telling it, this gets framed like some hidden body dump right under everybody's nose, covered in concrete with later anomalies under the structure, making it sound like the answer was buried in plain sight. And I understand why that one spread. It's cinematic. It's specific. It gives people that irresistible feeling that the answer was right there and the authorities either missed it or ignored it, which, let's be honest, is exactly the kind of thing people latch onto fast in a case like this. The problem is, it's a lot weaker than the way people tell it now. The construction timeline matters. What police publicly said about it matters. And the biggest thing that gets lost in the retelling is simple. Law enforcement did not treat that lead like some buried smoking gun they just refused to dig up. It may be the most famous rumor attached to this case. It is also nowhere near as sturdy as the internet version makes it sound. And then there's the green van. And if you're new to this case, when people say the van, here's what they mean. Because people throw that around like it's obvious, but it's not. There were reports tied to the early investigation about a suspicious van, usually described in later retellings as a green van, seen in the area around the time the woman disappeared. Depending on which version you hear, it was parked near the house seen in the neighborhood or tied to one of those witness leads that sounds incredibly important until you realize five different people have told it five different ways over 30 years. And that's why it stuck. It's visual. It's easy to remember. You tell people there was a creepy van near a house where three women vanished, and congratulations, you've just handed the public a detail they can gnaw on until retirement. But a suspicious vehicle is a lead. That's all it is, unless you can tie it to something real. A witness memory can matter. It can also get reheated so many times, it stops being a report and starts becoming one of those details everybody swears they know. Even if nobody can pin it down the same way twice. So yes, the van belongs in this story, but no, it does not get to become the story. And then you've got the porch light. Look, this one gets repeated like it's the opening frame of the whole crime. Broken porch light, broken globe, broken glass outside the house. And the second people hear that, their brain starts writing a whole scene for them. Somebody got grabbed, somebody struggled, and something violent happened right there on the porch. Well, maybe, but maybe not, and that's the issue. The broken porch light is real enough as a reported detail. It entered the case early. People remember it for a reason, but the image has gotten way stronger than the proof. Broken glass outside a house is a detail, yes. By itself, it is not a confession, and it sure as hell is not a full reconstruction of what happened. And then finally, there's they knew the person theory. Three women vanished from a house, no giant signs of forced entry that everybody can point to and feel good about. So the instinct, of course, becomes, well, maybe whoever did this was known to them. Maybe somebody got the door opened. Maybe the threat didn't look like a threat until it was too late. And sure, that could be true. But people say it like it's a conclusion, when really it's just a framework. It helps you imagine the night, but it does not prove the night. That distinction matters a lot more than people act like it does. And then there's Robert Craig Cox. And yes, I'm mentioning him, because if I don't, somebody's definitely going to show up in the comments asking where the hell he is. Cox is a name that gets attached to this case because he later made statements people found suspicious, provocative, or just creepy enough to keep dragging back into the conversation. He had the kind of profile that makes people perk up fast in a case like this, and once his name gets in the bloodstream, well, it stays there. Fair enough. But again, we keep our feet on the ground here. Authorities did not treat his statements as clean proof that the Springfield 3 was solved. His name matters because it entered the case and people know it. But that's not the same thing as saying he closes the case, because he doesn't. And then, because every unsolved case in America eventually starts collecting extra nonsense, well, now you get the psychic layer. Visions, impressions, people who saw something, remote viewers, intuitives, all the usual carnival acts that show up whenever a real investigation leaves enough empty space for somebody to start selling certainty. And I'm acknowledging it because it exists. I'm also leaving it right there because none of it has ever moved this case one inch closer to resolution. And that's the real problem with the Springfield 3. There's no shortage of things people can say, but there is a shortage of things that can stand on. And after all that, the garage, the van, the porch light, the known person theory, Cox, the fringe nonsense, you still end up right back in that house on East Del Mar. That's the part that really gets me. All that noise and the case never really leaves that house. So if you strip away all the extra stuff this case has collected over the years, the garage talk, the van talk, the names people throw around, the psychic nonsense, the porch light mythology, all of it, what are you actually left with? Well, not much. And that's exactly the problem. Because the record in this case stays stubbornly small. And to be fair, law enforcement has long treated this as foul play, not some voluntary disappearance. That much is pretty clear. But foul play is a category, not an answer. It tells you these women didn't just wander off. It does not tell you what actually happened in that house, or just outside it, or who made sure they never came back. You've got a house that still seems to say they made it home. Cars outside, belongings still there. The basic shape of ordinary life still sitting where ordinary life was supposed to be. But the house never tells you how that ordinary life ended. Did all three women fully settle in that night? Maybe, maybe not. Did whatever happened start inside the house? At the doorway? Maybe just outside? You can lean one way or the other, sure, but the record never hands you the clean version. And that's before you even get to the first few hours. Because if the house changed before investigators really got a hold of it, if things got touched, moved, swept up, erased, remembered wrong, repeated wrong, or just folded into the legend over time, then part of this case may have been slipping away before anybody even understood what they were looking at. That's a brutal thing to sit with. Because then you're not just dealing with what happened. You're dealing with what got lost before anybody knew it mattered. It keeps asking for an answer the record still cannot produce. And that's where the story turns into something worse than just unsolved. The hard part about the Springfield 3 case is how little it still gives you. No physical discovery that forces one version of the story to finally win. Just a house that seems to say they got home, and a record that never explains what happened after that. So after all the years, after all the theories, after all the names, rumors, sightings, confessions, dead ends, and false certainty, the same questions are still sitting there. What happened in that house, or just outside it, in the hours after they came home? Was one of the women the target and the other two simply there when it happened? Did investigators lose something critical before they ever realized what they were looking at? And how does a case this well known, this heavily worked, still never produce the one piece of evidence that makes it stop moving? Because by morning, three women should have been in that house, but they weren't. We've covered the story, and these are the shadows they leave behind. Thanks for being here tonight. If you want more stories like this, you know where to find me, you know where the links are. And if you choose to support the channel, it really helps. I'll see you next time.